Welcome and thank you very much for joining us. Today we'll be discussing some interesting things that happened to myself and a crew that managed to make our way over to Ukraine during the summer months. Of course, you may be familiar with me. I host the Closing Market Report here on the radio station in the afternoon, Commodity Week on the weekends, and I'm involved with agriculture in many ways, including with University of Illinois Extension, where I actually work in the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences. This summer, myself and several other Extension employees went to Ukraine, including Kevin Brooks, who's with us. Good morning to you, Kevin. Thanks for joining us today.
Good morning, Todd.
And Michelle Norris is along. She works out of the Champaign Center here and covers human and community development.
Good morning, Todd.
And George Sipar, who is an agronomist out of the Springfield Center of U of I Extension.
Good morning.
Well, and we're going to take up the subject of Ukraine and the trip that we took in July, the latter half of July this year. And I want to start by discussing, having Kevin just explain why it is that we went on the trip and then maybe take up some of the more interesting points from everywhere.
Okay. Well, the purpose of the trip, Todd, was to several fold. In that it's a great opportunity for training for university personnel in diversity, education, and looking at other cultures and such as our society changes and we're getting more and more people from other countries and dealing with that. There's also a business aspect in doing business against or across other cultures. The agriculture in Ukraine is relatively similar to here, and we have a number of Illinois companies that will be doing and are doing business over there, and there's some educational aspects to being able to help Illinois businesses operate successfully in Ukraine.
I want to start and give everybody just an opportunity to talk about the most interesting part of the trip to you, whatever that happened to be, whether it was something that happened to you, whether it was a comparative thing from years past. And, George, maybe if you could take that up for
me. Yeah, the thing that stands out in my mind, we had a discussion, as you remember, with a number of farmers, and one of the farmers that we were looking at a collective farm, the $5 million Soviet-era dairy farm that was kind of in shambles, and it was crumbling, and it was had been pretty well looted and dilapidated, and it was kind of a very traumatic experience for them to see this $5 million facility in ruins, and it was trying to be sold for about $30,000. And I asked the farmer, are you better off today than you were before? And his comment was, I'm a lot better off now because I'm free. And it really drove home that, you know, even though a lot of what they had in terms of the collective farming system and some of the infrastructure that they had, there really was this kind of heavy-handed oppression. And now that that's gone, his take on it was that he's a lot better off now because he has the opportunity, if he's motivated and interested, to do a lot of different things. So I guess that was the thing that stood out in mind, just his kind of a really an inspirational that he's free and he has now the opportunity to do what he wants to. And even though that the infrastructure maybe has some rebuilding to go, he was in a much better position.
And it was something we heard several places along the way. Michelle, what was the most interesting thing for you?
I guess I could probably tag off a bit on what George is saying. My experience was rather unique, actually, because I'd visited the country before. I'd lived in Ukraine as a Peace Corps volunteer in the late 90s. So it was really interesting for me to have the opportunity to go back as part of my extension professional development and the work that I do now in community and economic development. What struck me the most was in the 10 years that I had been gone, the changes. It seemed to be, in some instances, nearer the urban areas, there'd been a lot more development, a lot more foreign cars on the road, a lot more activity that tended to look Western, so to speak. And I think from the perspective of American involvement there and American economic activity there, that's a really exciting thing. The other side of that, too, was in some of the rural areas, it almost seemed that there may have been a little bit more of a decline, a little bit more of an increase in rural poverty. So those two dichotomies together were very interesting, I think, in terms of how future activity plays out for Ukraine, as well as other entities and governments and countries that become involved there as well.
We did fly into Kiev. Kiev is a city of, 2 million, I believe. And that one, interestingly enough, as you mentioned, looked very Western, and not European, but very Western in terms of the traffic flow that was there. They did have a few traffic jams. The biggest difference I noticed in a couple of things that is everything is straight up, and while it was 2 million people, it only took 15 minutes to get from the dead center of the city to out to the rural countryside. They have adopted SUVs, very large sedans, big cars, much like the United States has, as opposed to the western side of Europe, which has much smaller vehicles. And I thought that was kind of an interesting sort of thing. And then once you got outside of Kiev, maybe 70 or 80 miles, as you said, things really fell off quickly. And we were much more in what you would think of as an Eastern European country as opposed to a Western European country. Kevin Brooks, what was the most interesting thing you saw?
For myself, this was my third trip to Ukraine, and I was watching my colleagues change and adapt to a situation that they were unfamiliar with. When you're thrown into a country like Ukraine, when you're standing in a field, things look remarkably like they do here in central Illinois. But that's kind of where it ends, because the people and the cultures are so vastly different. And watching them adapt and change to the situation was kind of interesting for me.
I'll take up 2 points of interest for me. There was a mural in Herol. We visited a college there. This is a small town, about 15,000 people. And we say college, but really they're about mid-high school on to maybe 20 years of age, and they did some training, kind of a vocational agriculture tech school. And there was a mural on the wall that set things out for me in terms of how comparative this was to the state we live in. We'd seen at that point a lot of Ukraine. It looks very much like Illinois. The flora, the fauna was there. And in the mural, there was a red fox. And I made note of that because not only was the flora and the fauna there, but apparently the animals are very close. I saw something that looked like a red-tailed hawk. I'm not sure that that was the case, but it was pretty close. And this country is very close to here in the Midwest in terms of the way the landscape is shaped. The difference for me was that when you looked out across the horizon, the thing you didn't see were homesteads because everybody lived in towns. As opposed, and they've got some problems with that as it happens, simply because there's no way to get to some of the land because it's landlocked if you happen to farm it. The other thing, this is one of the more fun things that happened on the trip, and we've talked about some things that are pretty straightforward. But the night, George, that you and I sat in Kiev, and frankly, folks, we drank a lot while we were there. I must admit, I had more to drink in those two weeks than I had in, 10 years. Not to excess, but every place you went, the hospitality was there, and they wanted to toast, and they always toasted with vodka. This night, we did not drink, if I remember correctly, but we sat there and just giggled. Yorgi Yorgovich.
That's right.
We'd been in town we'd been in Ukraine for a week then, and I think it all just sort of came to a head. And Michelle, you were in the other room just listening to us.
I couldn't see, but I could hear, and the effect was very vivid.
I haven't had that. I haven't. That harkened all the way back to my childhood. So it was an interesting trip for me. One of the things, and I'd like to get your take on this, and I wish that Dave Seibert, who was the other person who had gone along with us, was able to be here today. Unfortunately, he couldn't make it in. And Dave set this off for me. We were in a pasture with a man who had a really very nice herd of cattle, and their cattle are beef cattle and milking herd both. And we're in a pasture, and Dave simply looked down at the pasture, which was, beautiful in terms of the landscape. There was a nice pond there, and it rolled nicely. But there were just weeds in this pasture. And he said, why don't you manage this? Why don't you mow it? Why don't you, try to manage these weeds so you can get some better gain on these cattle? And the guy simply said, I don't own it. And he was actually just using it. Not only did he not own it, but he didn't happen to rent this land either. So he was just using this as rangeland, but not leasing it. And Dave said something that really struck me, which was that ownership, they've got to have ownership in order to be entrepreneurial. And I started thinking about that and what that meant for democracy. And it seems to me that as nations like Ukraine and some of the other former Soviet states make their way towards democracy, that it's more than just getting to vote, that there's more to it, that they have to be able to take ownership of their nation in some form. And part of that is being able to have a title to say, yeah, this land belongs to me. And they don't. Not they have to have the ability to vote, and they have to have the legal authority to own a piece of property, it seems. And I think that there's a long way to go, and we miss that when we look at capitalism sometimes around the globe. Just one of my thoughts about the things that I think I learned while I was in Ukraine. Did anybody pick up on that or other topics that they really learned about Ukraine or just something that really struck you?
I would totally agree with you there, Todd. And I think it's very interesting. We all saw a few years back this really exciting television commentary and these vivid pictures of the Orange Revolution and all these types of context. And I think as Americans, we often look at something like that and really attribute it to it's the triumph of democracy. We really are seeing a former Soviet state rise up to its potential and begin to meet us on the market levels and the governmental levels we're used to. But then I think an important thing to consider about that, too, is that you're not necessarily starting from the same points of reference as we are here in the States. It's really exciting when those types of things happen. But then you've got a legacy of a Soviet institutional environment where everything was state-owned and state-run. And to change your mental conception of that overnight is something that actually takes a little bit longer. There are lots of institutional challenges in Ukraine, as you mentioned, the idea of land ownership and buy-in and an accountability to something that is actually yours. But I think that there are similar situations, too, in just looking at the legal system and the governmental system and how the populace really views its validity and accountability. And they've got some ways to go, I think, still. They're still struggling with that and becoming what we look at as really democratic.
Listeners, if you'd like to get involved in our conversation today, we're talking about Ukraine and a recent trip that I took along with our four guests to Ukraine as part of University of Illinois Extension. You're welcome to do that. Please give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. Or if you're local, that's 333-9455, and we'd be glad to take your call. We have a call, actually, already, and we'll get to them right away. Caller on line one, thank you for calling in. Do you have a question for us today?
Yes, I have a question. I should first point out that when you were speaking about property ownership, you were really bringing up the issue of the tragedy of the commons that Hartman came up with, that if people don't own things, they have no reason to take care of them. The question I have is, my grandfather came from the Ukraine, and my understanding is that the Ukraine was, at least even before World War II, one of the leading anti-Semitic regions in the world, that pogroms essentially started in the Ukraine area. And first, is that true? And if so, have they come to terms with that history? And are they making any movements in order to prevent that in the future? I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I don't know whether we could answer that question for sure or not, and I'll defer to Michelle, who has the most background in Ukraine.
I think that what the caller expressed is actually something that's fairly common, and historically speaking, has actually come up as well. Historically speaking, as I said, there was considerably a legacy of anti-Semitism, or prior to World War II, and types of activities that occurred in some of the western parts of Ukraine were fairly similar to what we saw occurring in Poland and some of the other areas that experienced a real challenge in terms of Jewish populations. I would think that one thing that is a little bit different, or we might look at a different perspective, is that once the Soviet Union did take over, theoretically, this was supposed to be a religionless society. So I think in some instances, those particular aspects of religion perhaps aren't as vivid, not only in speaking of Judaism, but in many cases, other types of Christianity and any other religions that actually would consider to be attributing there. Soviet Union was very vast. There are numbers of cultures there that are Islamic cultures. So definitely, those types of topics do come up often, and I think oppression for other religions also is something that's come up often as well.
I guess one other observation that was really of interest to me is when we were there and just learning a little bit about their history as a country and not realizing that during World War II, between Hitler and Stalin, that, what did they say, 10 million people were killed in the country, and it really gives you a sense of perspective as far as what they've lived through. And we talked a little bit about their outlook on life and adopting to democracy, and they really have a pretty traumatic history that they've had to weather and will certainly have to bear for years to come.
What is it, 1 in 3, I think? Perished, yeah. in
the Soviet Union,
right.
and those countries, you know, and they do some interesting things. Their museums, and we did have some time to travel and see some things. Their museums were just incredible. I haven't been in museums that were so terribly sad. We were in a World War II museum that was just awfully sad.
Right.
The interesting thing for me was that you could touch everything. Mm-hmm. They really said, you know, here, reach out and touch a wrecked motorcycle, and they'd have a photo of somebody who actually perished on a motorcycle. And how they ended up with the photo is beyond me, but those were things that were there. Ukraine, interesting. Ukraine's never been a nation unto its own until now, if I remember correctly from history, from what they told me, that the Ukraine had always been occupied in some form and had never have been their own nation. So they're treading certainly new eras at this time. Again, if you'd like to join our conversation today, just give us a call. The number is 800-222-9455 or 333-945 locally. We're talking about Ukraine and some experiences that University of Illinois Extension helped provide to myself and four of our guests today, including Kevin Brooks. Kevin, this was your third trip. How have things changed, and when was your first one?
My first one was in the fall of 2003. And in the rural areas, it was quite shocking to go there and to see a desperate plight of people. A lot of alcoholism, people walking down rural roads at night, intoxicated, not just a few people, but within a mile you'd see dozens. And we had a fear that they were going to be hit by a car. Just a lot of negativism and such at that time. People did walk a lot. What I've seen differently is in the rural areas you see fewer people walking, so they're getting rides somewhere. Generally speaking, in 2003, the people wore the same set of clothes every day that I was around them. Now you would see maybe two or three sets throughout the week. So minor things, you can see things getting better, but it is rather shocking when you go there. In the rural areas, the other thing that I've noticed that has changed, not as much negativism about their plight, because things are starting to get better, but in 2003, just constant complaining and such. And when I heard some anti-Semitic comments and such, and they were very few on my first trip, it had to do with trying to find somebody to blame for their plight. But overwhelmingly, what I run into is an overall sympathy of what happened to people of Jewish origin back under Hitler during World War II. And there's a very nice park set up at Babi Yar where over 100,000 people lost their lives at the hands of the Nazis. That's in the western part of Kyiv.
Their national motto, I think we heard this a couple of times. Is this right? Is this actually a national motto, or did the people just repeat this? Ukraine, we're not dead yet. Is that right? We heard that a couple of places. This is a country and a people that have really suffered. I mean, Stalin starved them out not once but twice, and they got starved out a couple of times, despite the fact that they're a breadbasket and hoarded apparently the food in warehouses right next door to them, right in their own communities. And so during World War II, lost so many people. Ukraine has been through serious depopulation over time. Russia and under Stalin put Russians in, so it's kind of an interesting mix of people as you get there. Tell me about just a little bit about our guide as we were there, and his name was Nikolai. And Nikolai was probably as interesting a character as I've come across in my entire life. Where did you meet this fellow?
I met Nikolai as my interpreter on my first trip there. And with Nikolai, he was able to get me into and see a lot of different things that you just normally don't get to see. It's off the beaten path type of a thing. He apparently had some type of high position under the former regime, and it was in civil aviation with some type of military aspect to it. But when the Soviet Union collapsed, air travel within Ukraine basically collapsed, so he didn't have a job. And so he makes his money now being basically an interpreter and also deals with businesses, et cetera. He's quite the individual, quite resourceful of an individual. Just a little bit about Nikolai. You were talking about World War II. Millions of Soviet soldiers lost their lives, and he has their grandfather they never, ever heard from again. So that family, you know, suffered that way and different things. But very interesting guy.
Yeah, well, to say the least. Nikolai on occasion would say he seemed, and I'm not sure that this was the case, that he would lean a little more towards the eastern side into Putin's mm-hmm. Russia, and he would say things about Ukraine. I'm not sure that that was the case, but maybe he just said this for my benefit. And knowing Nikolai, this may be the case, things that would go along the lines of on the Orange Revolution. They wanted freedom, and now they're unemployed. And the move towards democracy and capitalism. So it gives you an interesting perspective on the divide that is there in Ukraine. What do you think, George, Ukraine represents for the future, not in terms of democracy, but in terms of agriculture? What is their capacity, in your opinion, and as an agronomist? And will they compete on the world stage?
Boy, I got to think so. I mean, we looked at some of the soils that were as dark and black as Champaign County, just a tremendous wealth, and really the resources are there that are poised to do quite a bit. So I think down the road, once they get their infrastructure ramped back up and they get some basic production skills and they kind of sort out where they need to go, I think they're going to really be, back to where they were, a breadbasket for not only that part of Europe, but really probably the world. Talking about Nikolai, I guess the one thing that sticks in my mind, he was very animated, he was very opinionated, and we had a chance to drive around with him. And I still have a very clear memory of going through traffic in Kiev and him not holding the steering wheel at all and motioning with his hands and trying to make a very emphatic point. And he sure got my attention as he was trying to make that point. But I think you raised kind of the real key issue, where will they go? About half the country seems to be leaning pro-West, half leaning more towards closer ties with Russia. And, what direction they go and to what extent or where on the continuum they land is going to be interesting to watch.
Agronomically, when you look down, did you see weeds, I mean, that you recognized?
We saw the same type of weeds, and that was really kind of an eye-opener. We saw pigweeds, we saw lamb's quarter, we saw really much the same spectrum we'd have in central Illinois. So there's just a lot of similarities. The one big difference is that we tend to get a little bit more moisture here. We're favored with better conditions later on in the growing season. They tend to get most of their rainfall early in the season, then it dries off. So that's a major limiting factor. But, boy, as far as soils, weeds, pest spectrum, just a lot of similarities to what we find here.
Oh, by the way, I wanted to thank everybody on this note, on the drive from Poltava to Kiev, and we were in a couple of sedans on the second day. Mm-hmm. I wanted to thank everybody for leaving me in the car with Nikolai, or actually moving me back into the car with Nikolai. I appreciated that greatly. we were in, how long were we in that car? 4 hours? I don't think stopped talking to us.
Man.
he was on a roll that day. That was a lot of fun. Actually, it was a lot of fun. Although you ended up, I think, Georgie, listening to most of that. He couldn't see me in the back. I took a couple of naps in the afternoon.
Yeah, I made the mistake. He kept turning around to make a point, and I was in the back seat, and he'd let go of the wheel and turn around, and I thought, boy, this is going to be a memorable trip for us. But, it was quite the experience. And I guess, the other thing that really stands out was our luggage that was delivered in a van that was also hauling rabbits. That was kind of a once-in-a-lifetime type of experience that I'll always remember, and that was certainly memorable.
Yeah, travel in Ukraine was interesting. The day we arrived in Kiev, they picked us up, and I didn't really make note of this until I got back. In something that was a 1980s vintage era, bit like a Vanagon. It was a VW. It was a VW van. And we had, if I counted right, there were five of us, and we had 20 pieces of luggage, five of which were the giant size. And they had one van, and they met us with six people. Mm-hmm. So there were 11 people total and 20 pieces of luggage. And how we got all of us in that van is still beyond me, including the luggage. I don't know how we did that. And we were so excited that day just to be on the ground in Ukraine that it was, I didn't really make much note. There was no air conditioning. It wasn't particularly hot. Drive. I thought the van didn't have shocks, but after I started thinking about it, so the van had shocks. We just had a lot of weight in the van as we made that 200-mile trip.
And the road was pretty rough.
Well, the road was pretty rough, but it was a blacktop. It just hadn't been cared for 10 years or so since, since the collapse probably in 91. Talk to me a little bit about that, because it seems to me that under the Soviet system, I don't know how they managed the collapse. I can't imagine what happened to Ukrainians when suddenly a system that provided them everything was there one day, and the next day it was just gone.
Yeah, imagine living in the United States and find out that your government institution no longer is running, the police, your money is not worth anything. Wake up and you may go to a job, but you're not going to get paid. And that's pretty much what people there had to go through when the collapse of the system happened. And if we do run into any negative comments, there's some frustration with people who went through that with the West, in that for some reason or another, they seem to feel like the West could have done something about that. I'm not sure what could have been done, but if there's any hard feelings, it might have something to do with that. But it was a very unnerving time. People were very, had some in-depth conversations, scared for their safety, not knowing what was going to go on. Just their lives just turned over almost overnight.
Yeah, speaking of scared for your safety, this is not a trip for the disheartened, for the folks who want comfort, that's for sure. It was kind of funny. Kevin, you put the trip together, and how fast did you find people to go on the trip? I mean, I said yes right away, but it was a month or something like that after you told us we were going, that you said, well, we're going to leave in a month or a month and a half. Everybody who went wanted to travel.
Everybody who went jumped right at it. There were a few other people that I asked, or people that knew what I was doing, what we were putting together, and they're kind of like, why are you doing that? For several standpoints, as having to do with this is not exactly Western Europe in terms of its development. I've always felt safe there, but it's, you know, you're not stepping into AAA hotels.
No.
Anything like that. I've ridden in small Ladas, which are kind of like an old Colt car without mufflers or brake pads. It's just a different situation. So some people reacted that way. And also got some reaction is why are we helping them to develop agriculturally? And my comment with that is, because of their vast resources there and the land, Ukraine is developing overnight. I mean, it's developing quickly. It's going to take a while in the rural areas and stuff. They have a long ways to go. They lack money. They lack general know-how. They do lack some moisture. Their government is still extremely corrupt in dealing with that. But what you're seeing there is basically a three-way divide, in my opinion anyway. There are Russian interests, Western European interests, and American interests, and it's a matter of not if Ukraine is going to develop, it's going to be a matter of which one of those areas is going to be involved in helping Ukraine to develop and then be able to glean from the benefits of being able to help with that. In Illinois, we have a number of businesses, even here in central Illinois, small companies in small towns such as Arthur and Arcola that are doing major business in Ukraine right now, because when they collapsed, they have no pesticide production. Equipment manufacturing doesn't really exist there. And so those are opportunities for Illinois businesses.
Listeners, you're listening to Focus 580 on WILL Urbana. Your opportunity to call us at 217-333-9455 locally, or 217-800-222. Actually, it's just 800-222-9455. Toll free to join our conversation about Ukraine. We're reintroduce our guests this morning. Kevin Brooks is with us, along with Michelle Norris and George Sapar. All of us work for University of Illinois Extension and spent a couple of weeks in July this nation of Ukraine, a developing nation. I don't know whether I wanted to call it. I don't know where to put it, actually, on the world map of economics. When you're in Kiev, it seems like a Western nation. When you're in Poltava, which was 200 miles away, it looks a lot more third world, but it's not on the really extraordinarily poor side, though people were pretty desperate in parts of that nation. When we talk about agricultural development, what is it that that struck you most about who we saw, where it is that you think Ukraine is headed? I mean, in terms of, we saw the Syngentas, we saw Northrop King, we saw Pioneer, we heard about Louis-Dreyfus. These are all companies that here in the United States, if you're involved in agriculture, you certainly know about.
Well, I guess the one thing that stands out as you drive around, and there is a lot of interest from the companies that you just mentioned. I was surprised, though, Todd, the number of people that had questions about organic production. Mm-hmm. And I think as we talked a little bit before, it's probably just organic by default because some of them can't afford inputs, and that's what their main interest is. But I was a little bit caught off guard that was such a high level of interest in that whole system of production. As we talked earlier today, about how do you maintain certification to make sure if something is going to be produced that it is, in fact, organic and it's certified and you have that kind of quality control in that whole system. And that may be more of a challenge than anything else. But to kind of just respond to your question, that was a surprise for me in terms of interest in that whole area.
I suppose we really haven't discussed why we were there and some of the things, and we've got a couple listeners waiting to talk to us. But, Kevin, could you tell just a little bit about the presentations that were made in the Poltava State Agrarian Academy that we visited?
Okay, well, my previous contacts had met with officials from Haral College, Hometetz College, and Poltava State Agrarian Academy. And through that, we put together a conference. The main part of it was to try to build relationships, et cetera. And from that, though, we did do some presentations. George was a crop scientist, spoke in terms of corn and soybean production. And Dave Seibert, of course, did the animal science end of it. The pork industry there, if you're talking about the future, that's probably an area of major growth. I mean, there were livestock numbers of basically collapsed in the last 10 years, but mm-hmm. that's as other countries are looking at Ukraine for exports and such, I think that the livestock, particularly with swine, is going to grow. And then we had Michelle with us, of course, to talk about community and economic development. Of course, there are rural villages there. I mean, agriculture is pretty much the main game in town, just like in rural United States, but they're just much more in dire need of development. People just massive amounts of unemployment, children without health care, et cetera. But again, in looking at this, I mean, there's obviously a humanitarian aspect of it, which you can't help but feel when you're over there. But from the advantage to Illinois, though, is that there are economic opportunities there to help develop that country and such.
And I took up the subject of ethanol while we were there. While I'm not an expert in ethanol, I've managed to report on it enough, and I was actually the only one who volunteered, I suppose, to take up that topic. We've got a couple of folks that are waiting online, and we'll go to line one. Do you have a question for us this morning? Thanks for calling in.
Yes, is that me?
Yes, it is.
Okay, thank you. I have lots of questions, but I about 10 years ago, we met a couple who were here from the Ukraine. Woman was at the University of Illinois. The husband had been like within 15 miles of Chernobyl when the Chernobyl accident happened. He had all sorts of health problems. But one of the things I wanted to ask about is there still a prejudice against agricultural products from the Ukraine because of the possibility or the fear that of other countries might have that the food or the ground, the land, would still be contaminated from the Chernobyl accident? I'll take your opinions or your insights off the air. Thanks.
Okay, thank you.
These are only insights and opinions, and I don't pretend to be a radiological expert. Western countries, experts have been all over that country and done measurements and such. Most of Ukraine is pretty much the radiation levels are the same as what they are here. Yeah. Myself, knowing the corruption of their government, I thought, you know, I want to find out for myself. So I bought a Geiger counter, which I took over there. And somewhat to my surprise, everywhere where we were at, which was basically Kiev, east to Poltava, and slightly east of there, the background radiation levels were the same as here in central Illinois, or maybe even slightly lower.
Yeah, we urged you to put that Geiger counter somewhere else besides taking measurements while we were on the plane, because it's kind of a funky-looking little device. but you managed to get it out on occasion, and we never got asked about it. I was a little surprised that electronic device didn't garner more attention while
they
we
saw
were
it,
the
asked
planes.
What it was, and didn't ask me any more about it. It kind of surprised me. You guys, I think, were halfway expecting to see a fighter escort.
I thought we might.
Boyceville Airport. I can't explain it, but did see a minor
That was more than a minor.
Okay, I saw a spike in the radiation levels north of Chernobyl when we were in the airplane as we were descending, which was a little bit surprising. Apparently, they have been upfront that it is still leaking, but I think most of it actually goes with the climate and such. The wind direction, most of it goes north.
Yeah, we have a caller on line two as well, and we'll ask you to join the conversation at this point. Thanks for waiting. You have a question for us?
I'd like to ask a question about mowing. I see pictures from Russia that often have interesting roadsides with the vegetation intact. The other day I had to go up 51, like hundreds of miles of mown expressway, and it's so sterile and so uninteresting and so energy-consuming. I wonder what your reaction was to mowing in Russia. It may be by default. It's a little bit like herbicides that can't afford it, but it is I think it's a different attitude.
Yeah, I'm not sure that it really was. The only accident we saw was a car ran in the back of a mower on the highway. That was the and I'm surprised we didn't see other accidents. Frankly, it was a pretty free for all. But it seemed to me that a lot of the they may not have been mown, and it's probably a little different because the livestock, while it was decimated, everybody owned something, and frankly, everybody owned a cow or a goat, and I can't tell you how many animals were just in the ditches, and they were tied there.
They used the right of way for their cattle. They tether them onto the right of way, and they make hay out of the right of way.
Both.
At times it can be a little bit dangerous because the livestock are right there alongside the road, typically on a chain. But I've been through rural areas where they're scattered all over the road, and it kind of comes on you rather quickly. So it can actually be on the dangerous side. And one of the conversations I had with Nikolai, we were talking about mowing and such, and both lawn mowing for homeowners, but also in the...
Yeah, they don't do that.
The ditches. He really didn't understand why that would be such a big business here in the United States.
Yeah, the mowing of the lawns. Yeah, nobody mowed a lawn. Actually, and I thought it was rather unique that even we dropped by a cemetery one day because it happened to have a good view. It was on a bluff, and we were overlooking what town? I don't remember. Were we overlooking Poltava?
It was Poltava.
Yeah, we were overlooking Poltava, and the cemetery was just full of weeds. And it wasn't really taken care of, but it was obviously used. There were fresh grave sites there.
That's actually where we find some of our better prairies. We find dead cemeteries that aren't mown. it has something to do with gene pool preservation, too. So, interesting program, and thank you very much.
Thank you for calling. And if you'd like to call in and talk to us, we've got maybe 15 to 20 minutes left. Give us a call at 217-244-9455. Or actually, 217-333-9455 or 800-222-9455. And you can join our conversation this morning here on Focus 580. We're talking about Ukraine. What are other interesting things maybe did you happen to note about Ukraine and how it's changed, Michelle, from earlier years to now, or just something that struck you on the trip that you hadn't made note of before?
Well, I might comment a little bit further on what the caller was just discussing, and you too, Todd, as well, about this issue of mowing and landscaping and some of these things that we tend to invest a lot of time and money in here in the States. And something that always struck me about Ukraine and more urbanized areas and some areas that are even maybe not entirely urban, it's a geography and that tends to go up and not out. So when we think about our suburban neighborhoods here in the States or even some places where, people own necessarily, maybe an acre or more of land that they would even just consider a yard and they keep it up and they take care of it, really isn't the situation there when you have a society that, for the most part, lives in an apartment building. So what was really interesting for me 10 years ago, I lived in a town of about 100,000. and I basically walked everywhere I went, which you just wouldn't think that to be the case here in the States. But everyone lived in these Soviet-style apartment buildings that were about five floors. Yeah. So your society was in the air more than it was necessarily spread out.
Yeah. Poltava was a town of 300,000. We walked everywhere there. I asked one of the students, because we were with students a lot of the time while we were in Poltava, where they lived. They said they'd lived on the outskirts of town, and I wanted to know how long it took them to get in town because they didn't ride the bus. He said it was a 20-minute walk. Mm-hmm. Well, we know that takes about that's only about a mile, I mean, or thereabouts. So, you know, these places are straight up. They literally are straight up, and that was a little odd to get used to. The only place really that we saw lawns is when we were I wouldn't call it a lawn. It was a fenced area. When we were in the really rural, remote areas and it was a smaller community, we were in a couple of communities or by them of maybe 400 or 500 people. And they had what you would more consider just individual homes as opposed to apartments. But it was really odd. I Googled, in fact, Kiev, trying to figure out where the airport was, because you can look down on these things on the maps using maps at Google and other places. And when I was looking down on from the satellite photos, I just really could not understand how they stuck 2 million people in this small of area. I just, from the satellite photos, you were thinking, well, this can't be bigger than Champaign-Urbana. It just didn't look that big. But it really is straight up. And they're building, and it's kind of interesting. There are some places, especially around Kiev, where you can see some individual homes being built. But I've got photos from the bluff where I can count maybe 16, 17 skyscrapers, relatively speaking, those, not skyscrapers, but 12-floor buildings, and you can count those buildings that are being put up. They're being put up at a really rapid pace, mm-hmm. but they're still building straight up. Hopefully they're doing better now at building, and I think they are, than they were in the Soviet era, because, man, their building standards really stunk. Oh, right?
Yeah.
Am I right, George?
We saw a lot of crumbling buildings, and we saw this thing that also stood out is just the difference in terms of building materials. You could look at a building and see four different type of bricks that they got a different load, and they just went ahead and put them in there. You know, the other thing, too, that strikes me just in terms of change that we're seeing is how some technologies are being widely adopted, and, certainly cell phones. All the students had cell phones,
yep.
and they were plugged in, but yet internet access, even at Poltava, was limited. It's getting better, and they just got high-speed internet as we were leaving, but, you look down the road and you look to see, wireless internet, I'm sure will take off in some of those rural areas, and maybe will be a huge opening for them.
It might be. Michelle, when you were there earlier, did everybody have a telephone, a landline telephone, or do they have cell phones now because that was the infrastructure that was easy to put in, much like it was if you travel to India or some other countries where they haven't had landlines, they all use cell phones, mm-hmm. and they've got a good cell phone system because it's all wireless, and so they're able to put towers up, but investing in landlines is much more expensive.
Yeah, and I think in some instances you are looking at that, and we probably all remember, we did spend a lot of time out on the village areas and some more rural farms, and you might see this farmer out on the field with his cattle, and he's holding a cell phone, and, we can't say specifically how that occurred, but my inclination would be to think that gentleman perhaps never even had a landline, that he jumped completely ahead of the technology. During the time that I was leaving Ukraine in the late 90s, cell phones were just starting to pop up and dot up in certain places, not very effective, lots of problems with signals and whatnot. Most everyone did have a landline if you lived in town, but more often than not, they were shared lines. Some of what we might used to consider, technology that was oriented toward the 50s maybe or 60s. Mm-hmm. I did have a telephone, but oftentimes there were several conversations taking place during my conversation.
Yeah, it was pretty interesting, as you said. Most of the folks had maybe two different outfits, but they all had cell phones. Food was cheap, but there were other things that were as costly as it was in the
United
States.
Cell phones there are actually a little bit more expensive than what they are here. Ukraine's definitely a country of a real small amount of the population that is very wealthy. And then you have everybody else. We've talked to some farm workers that were working for 10 hryvnias a day, which you divide that by five, that equates out to $2
a day.
$2 a day. Medical care is tough to come by. Even in Kiev, just to kind of give you an idea, though, Nikolai's daughter works as an attorney for a fairly well-known law firm, and her salary is about $600 a month, of which she has to pay $400 for her apartment. But then by the time she pays for her cell phone, which is going to run her probably a little bit more than here, that doesn't leave a lot of extra money.
No. Speaking of the medical system, you and I went on a goose chase one day, which was pretty wild. And this could not have happened in the United States. The last time you were in, you had met a couple of orphans, and you wanted to track one of them down. And she was in the hospital, so we actually... It was really weird for me, at least, in the way that it happened. Not that we did it, but that our ability to find somebody really surprised me. That this orphan had moved from a community a couple hundred miles away to Poltava. We were able to locate the orphanage. We went to the orphanage. She was in a hospital. We were able to locate the hospital, and then we went to the hospital. Went in, and they don't work like we do. You know, we had to sort of find an administrator. They made a couple of phone calls around, and we in a matter of 4 hours, we found a little girl that I don't think we would have ever gotten past the paperwork up front. I mean, it was really pretty odd, and you definitely do not want to get sick while you're in Ukraine. That hospital left a lot to be desired.
It was definitely a Sherlock Holmes type of situation in running this down, but definitely different standards in terms of that. They just more or less marched her right out, and there we were. Did want to mention, though, in Ukraine, though, because of the desperate situation in the rural areas, the number of orphans has just skyrocketed, a lot of kids without parents. Sometimes the parents are deceased. Sometimes they just can't take care of the kids financially, so they give them up to these adoptions. Plus, then the longevity for people used to be about the same as what it is here. Now I think it's about 70 years, but when you look at men in particular, some of the statistics come out that the average male now lives to be somewhere in the mid-50s range.
Yeah, running out of time, a couple of other notes that I wanted to make for the day. Population, since we started to talk about that a little bit. And you talked about a lot of orphans being there, but there are, after about age 20 years, you know, 17, 18, 19 years of age, we didn't see anybody, and they complained to us a bit about this, that there was a whole generation that was missing, that the young women and the women in general had made a decision that they weren't going to have babies. And there's a whole generation that sure looked like it was missing. I think I counted maybe three or four pregnant women. Given we were in a city of 300,000, a city of 2 million, that pretty much amazed me. And I can count on two hands the number of kids we saw.
Ukraine has a negative population growth.
And there, it's just really desperately moving quickly southward. Mm-hmm. And I guess that's part and parcel of the collapse of the Soviet system. Maybe it left over from the nuclear problem, too. I don't know. I mean, these seem to be... These are situations that they have to deal with, and they're going to have to deal with fairly quickly. The other thing is that their primary export, it appeared to be their young women, right? That's kind of crass, but am I right?
Yeah. That's
that, you know, we talk about you talk about things like Russian brides, but they're pushing their young women to be very. I think they dress more Western European than anything else, but. Very young, very beautiful, and their entire job was, the family's job was to get that young woman out of the country. Right?
Well,
you guys don't want to take this up. Is this too touchy for you?
I think it's a little bit of a societal thing, too. I mean, there is that perception of women in Ukraine and in former Soviet countries. There's a downside to it, too, that especially in Moldova, but in Ukraine... trafficking in women is also becoming a really major problem too. So,
well, I wasn't really wanting to make light of it. I was just making note that one, they didn't have any. The population was diving. They didn't have a whole generation, and that generation that is coming of age is, it really they're trying to move out of the country because of such desperate, you know, dire situation. And it appears that the young men sort of just drift off into whatever happens to happen to them. But the young women, they're really trying to market out of the country.
Yeah, some of the more enterprising business people in the agricultural section, though, are women entrepreneurs.
That was another note that and the glass ceiling sure looks like it's a lot higher there for women than it is here, meaning that women, we were all over that country, and I think I saw more women in positions of power than I did men throughout every, in Kiev, in Poltava, in the small communities, that they were, that women worked on a very equal basis. And maybe you spent more time there. Is there something else that I missed in that, or is that really the right perception?
No, I don't think so. I think that's pretty standard, and that was something that was also very common during the Soviet era too. This idea of equality, governmentally too. You see that as well. Women in positions of governmental power. So that, yeah, I think that definitely is a pretty fair perception.
Labor is labor under the Soviet system, and they didn't care which gender it happened to come from, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, relatively speaking, they went back to the beginning of our conversation. They lost, you know, 10 million people, and the women went to the factories like they did here in the United States, but no men came back. And so the Soviet, is that the way, at least that's the way I think Nikolai told me about it, that, you know, that they filled the jobs and that's what happened.
Mm-hmm.
All right. We're just at the end of our time period. Do you have one more thing you want to talk about?
I just wanted to mention something that's a little bit shocking for Americans when they go over there, is what happened to the collective buildings and facilities. When the collapse happened, and in the 5 years after that, as finances and such were in disarray, people either stole, dismantled, destroyed a lot of the buildings, which could have been used for development later on.
Thank you very much. We appreciate everybody being with us. George Sipar has been our guest, along with Michelle Norris and Kevin Brooks. And my name is Todd Gleason. We all work for University of Illinois Extension. It's been a pleasure being with you this morning here on WILL, and we appreciate your time.